In Nigeria's north, many of you are aware, there is a significant challenge, which I'll talk a little bit about tomorrow in my pastoral address, from a resurgent Islam that is significantly focusing and targeting Christians, Anglican Christians among them. And it is our great privilege to welcome to the Missionary Diocese of Cana East and to the Anglican Church in North America, His Lordship, the Right Reverend Marcus Dogo. And Mama Dogo, would you please stand? It's a wonderful privilege to have you among us. Bishop Marcus and I were consecrated bishops together. It is, he's telling me not to tell you this, but it is very important in Nigerian tradition to recognize that he was consecrated 2.5 minutes after me. That makes me his senior. And I actually think, Bishop, it was closer to 3.5 minutes by the time we got to you. And that makes all the difference in the world. But Bishop Marcus and Mama Dogo are personal friends of mine. And Brenda, some of you have been to their diocese. As you travel down the road next to their cathedral, you see the bullet holes in the wall of the cathedral where the Islamists targeted the Christians in their compound. These are our brothers and sisters in Christ with whom we are in relationship and fellowship. We're going to hear from the Dogos tomorrow. And sir and mummy, it is a great privilege to welcome you among us. This is mummy's first visit outside of Nigeria. So, welcome to the United States. And so I'd like to invite Archbishop Beach, sir, and Dr. Gatiss to come forward. This is our interviewer extraordinaire, Archdeacon Alan Crippen. And we're going to have much fun together. So please come and take a seat.
I'll give you all the hard ones.
Oh, yeah.
Well, let me echo our bishop's greetings to both of you for joining us this weekend. We are certainly honored by your presence. And I think to start out, we'd like to hear a little bit about your story, briefly, because we have some ground to cover. We're going to do this for about 30 minutes in case you're sleepy. You've crossed several time zones. So 30 minutes of conversation, then dessert, and then we'll be off to synod business. So, Your Grace, tell us a little bit about your story, your family, and your calling to ministry.
Okay. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, born and pretty much raised there. My wife and I, Allison is her name. We've been married for 34 years this past Sunday. And actually to the same people. I mean, we've got two children. James is 28. He lives in Washington, D.C., working at the Pentagon to keep us safe. And my daughter, Rebecca, is 25, and she's a teacher and teaches second graders in a little town north of Atlanta called Roswell. And they both walk with the Lord, and so that's good news. Neither one of them are married. That's not so, well, I don't know. Anyway, one's close. And so that's a little bit about my family. How much of my story, I mean, do you want, I mean, how much time we got here? Let me just say this. Abbreviated version is I come from a broken home. My parents were divorced when I was 8 because of my mother's inappropriate affairs and drinking. And when the drug scene hit the United States back in the late 60s, she got involved in all of that and became a hippie. She was eventually arrested on my 12th birthday. And I went to 5 different elementary schools during that time. And we lived in lots of places. I was basically a street kid for many of those times. When I went to live with my father, and he had remarried, they were involved in a church. And it was through that church that I first heard about Jesus in a personal way and asked him into my life. And then later on, through the ministry of Young Life, really yielded my life to the Lord and his lordship in my life. And it's been an adventure ever since. So that's a quick summary of my faith story in the early days.
Thank you.
So I want to hear somebody with an accent now.
All right.
you have a great accent.
Thank you.
Indeed. All right, Dr. Gatiss, tell us your story, a little bit about your family.
It's great to be here in America because I have an English accent, which means I sound 50% more intelligent than I really am. Which means I'm about a third as intelligent as Henry Jansma. So it's great to be here. I don't live in Downton Abbey. I live in Cambridge in England, and I often walk on paving stones which are older than your country. So it's great to be in such a place. I'm married to Kerry. We've been married 21 years. I know, I don't look old enough, do I? And we have three children. Joshua, who's 15 and is a great violin player. He's got a Hebrew name. And my middle daughter, Kara, which is a Greek name, meaning joy. She plays viola and does ballet. She's a great dancer, very elegant. Not quite sure where she gets it from, but it isn't me. And then my youngest is called Lucy, which is a Latin name. So there we are. All these ancient languages. And Lucy is irrepressibly jolly. Like her dad. Yes, thank you. And I grew up, I've lived all over the country in England. I'm from the northeast, so like all my family talk like that, which is a really good northeastern accent. The accents, and then I've also lived in the southwest where they talk more like that. And then I lived in the southeast, where it's in Kent. They talk like that. And then I moved to Manchester, which is in the northwest. But then going to university in Oxford knocked all of those things out of me. So I just sound posh now. My family in the north think I sound like a posh southerner. My southern friends think I sound like a brash northerner. So what can you do? I grew up going to Anglican churches, Church of England churches, wherever we moved in the country. I would go and we'd go to the local Anglican church. And I remember when I was about 10, there was a special evening service and a special speaker gave a special talk and encouraged us at the end of that to give our lives to Jesus by praying a special prayer. And I remember praying the special prayer when I was about 10. So I'm a big fan of youth ministry. I don't know if I became a Christian then, but I certainly was a significant moment for me, but it wasn't all an uphill kind of spiritual journey from then on. It wasn't really till I went to university, 18, 19, what do you say, college. I went to college. At the end of my first term of college, I was at Oxford. Everything was very exciting. I couldn't quite get my life, you know, it was just all too many opportunities. It was great. This, you know, working class guy from the north suddenly at Oxford University. And so I thought, I need to get my life sorted. So I drew a little post-it note of my life. I was young, so it only fitted on a little post-it note, right? So I drew a stick man in the middle, that was me, and then sort of a bit of the diagram for different parts of my life. And so there was a bit for friends, which is one of the reasons you go to university, right? Make friends for life. I met my wife there. Our eyes met across a crowded quad. Then there was a bit for music, so I was trendy and I was in a band in those days. You can probably find the music online, but don't go looking. Then there was a bit for history, which is the degree I was supposed to be studying. And then there was politics, because I was into the debating society, the Oxford Union, things like that. And then there was a little bit of the diagram for Jesus. Or a draw, as we heard earlier. A draw of my life was there, given over to Jesus. And then I went to a talk one evening. I was dragged along to a Christian Union talk. I say I was dragged along, but she had big blue eyes and blonde hair, so. Yeah, I appreciated the parallel. And there was a Baptist preacher preaching that evening, and he was preaching on, you can't serve God and money. You can't serve God and something else. And then he said, to illustrate this, let me ask you, if you drew a diagram of your life, who would be in the center of it? And I'm like, this guy's broken into my room. He's stolen my post-it notes and he's using it against me. And I thought, maybe someone had told him about it, but I had told nobody. Nobody knew that I had this post-it note of my life. And then he said, so maybe one of you're one of those kind of people who would put Jesus somewhere on the outside of your diagram. And he was preaching it directly at me and telling me Jesus needs to be not there, but in the middle. And that was also a really significant moment for me. So I'm a big fan of youth ministry and a big fan of student ministries because they were very significant in helping me in my walk with the Lord.
Dr. Gatiss, tell us about the Church Society. What is it? What do you do with it? What's its role in the UK and beyond?
Thank you. The Church Society is a very old evangelical Anglican organization in the Church of England, and you can tell we're good evangelicals because we do three things and they all begin with the same letter. So we do publishing, politics, and patronage. Publishing, we publish an old a theology journal and have been doing since the 19th century called Churchman. Do any of you subscribe to Churchman? Excellent, one or two, yes, good. Some of you may even contributed to it, I don't know. We publish books. I'll have some of my books tomorrow to show people if you'd like. At a magazine, we're on Twitter and Facebook. Please do follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Church Society and all sorts of things like that. I do a regular weekly video on the lectionary readings for that week. I do a sort of 5-10 minute exposition of the lectionary readings as a little video to resource people in the Church of England and elsewhere with good Anglican material. So that's our publishing side of things. The second thing was politics. So we're involved in political things on committees and synods and such things like that. It's great to be here in your synod and to see the politics. Who was it that said, where two or three are gathered together, there is church politics? Was it Aristotle or something? Anyway, we're political animals, aren't we? So politics is an inevitable part of being more than one of us in a room. So we have to be involved in that somehow. So I've been to Archbishop Welby's house and talked to him about issues to do with gay marriage and other things like that. I've been to, a couple of months ago, I was in 10 Downing Street with the Prime Minister's house to meet with her and other senior sort of faith leaders to talk about things, freedom of speech and other issues there. So we're involved in political things, publishing, politics. The third thing is patronage. And in the Church of England, we have this funny system where every church has a patron, so that when the vicar goes to glory, or just below that, to the bench of bishops, or if he just moves on to another parish, then there's a vacancy in the parish, and it is the patron's job in every church to come and help the parish find the next vicar. And we have the right of appointment to the church. Now, the Church Society, we have the right of appointment in about 130 parishes up and down the country, all over the country. You used to be able to buy and sell the right to appoint people to churches. You can no longer buy and sell it, but people can transfer their patronage to us, or if there's a new church plant, they can decide to assign their patronage to us. And so we're picking up more as people want to secure the future of their parishes within the messy situation of the Church of England. So publishing, politics, patronage, that's what we do. And I obviously do a bit of preaching as well. And what else do I do? Yes, I pray a lot.
Very good, thank you. Your Grace, we have never had a primate at a Canis Synod before. And we would like to hear your perspective on Anglicanism in the U.S. Now, we know the Episcopal Church is a train wreck, so we'll save you from briefing us on what's going on there. So give us a sense of the state of Anglicanism, Orthodox Anglicanism, in the U.S. and Canada.
Okay, good. Yeah, we won't mention the other group because I wouldn't consider that true Anglicanism. I mean, just to be honest. Well, just a quick overview. We are now in our 8th year, is that right, as a province? I think that's right. And we're now over 1,000 parishes. Last year, it looks like we planted at least one church a week, a little more than one church a week we planted as a province, which is pretty good. About 110,000 official members. Once South Carolina comes in, that'll change. We have this group called the Daughters of the Holy Cross. Any of you all involved in that? Anybody involved in the Daughters here? Nope. One or two? Wow. Well, Daughters of the Holy Cross is a group of women who pray, and we've now we have a thousand members of the Daughters of the Holy Cross who are praying every day for the clergy and for their churches and for things in their communities. So those are some pretty good things. You may not know, you're one of 30 dioceses in the Anglican Church in North America, and we have 51 bishops that are active. Some of those are retired, but they're still helping out. About 1,700, a little over 1,700 clergy in the Anglican Church in North America. What else can I tell you about the state of things?
Outlook for the future.
Outlook for the future. I think it's very positive, very exciting. We have numerous folks that are doing incredible, creative ministries, reaching people that are invisible, that hadn't been reached before, and I think that bodes well. Some of you have heard about Matthew 25. Have any of y'all heard about the Matthew 25 initiative? My eyes have just really been opened on some of the creative things that people in our churches just are doing because they're Christians, to reach the poor in their neighborhood or start schools, start organizations. There's one place in Baltimore that has a healing clinic outside a drug abuse place. So once a week, they set up a tent. Anybody that wants prayer for healing, they pray for them, and people are being healed. But anyways, things like that the church is doing, we're finding that when we plant an Anglican church near a college campus, that the young people are flocking to it, and so that's a good thing. So I could keep going on. I'm not sure exactly.
Well, that's a good start. Thank you. Okay. Dr. Gatiss, the state of Anglicanism in the mother country.
I was afraid you were going to ask me that. I would love to be as positive as Archbishop Foley, and I am positively Anglican. We need to have a positive view about the Church of England and the opportunities that we have as established church. It gives us all sorts of platforms for the gospel, great ways of preaching the gospel to the states and to the nation that we have. We have 16,000 churches up and down the country, so that's 16,000 platforms and pulpits and pews for the gospel. And I think as provided the gospel is being preached in some of those, then we have a right to be the established church. As soon as we stop preaching the gospel, I would rather we stopped being the established church. And that, unfortunately, is happening in some places. So in some places, the gospel is not allowed. It is discriminated against, and it doesn't have an easy time. The Church of England isn't the same as the Episcopal Church or even ACNA, I suppose, that we don't have quite such a, I don't know how to put it, command and control. It's not so centralized. We have a balance of powers within the system so that bishops can't do in the Church of England some of the things that I guess your bishops could do or certainly have done, which can be a blessing in many ways because it means we can get away with all kinds of good stuff that they can't stop us doing because they just don't have the power. But it also means that good bishops can't stop bad things happening in the way that they might like to do. Church discipline isn't in a good state, although it is being effectively used against some. So we had recently we've had some issues with gay clergy, those who are in same-sex unions, same-sex marriages, and they've been disciplined so that their licenses are taken away. They're no longer allowed to function in ministry. There was one particular scandal where there was a man who'd married his husband, and they were still living in the vicarage, and he was still functioning, and he managed to get himself elected to our general synod. But now that he's moved, he's going to move parishes. He's not allowed to have another job in the Church of England. He's got to move to a different part of the country with his husband. He's not allowed anywhere else in the Church of England. So he's now being disciplined out. So there are some instances of good things, proper church discipline actually happening. I wish I could say that was more universal and good. It also would be good if we had more life in the Church of England generally, not just disciplining out bad things. Our nation is desperately needy in parts of England. People don't know the name Jesus. They think that he doesn't even exist. There was no such person as Jesus. And, you know, in some parts of England, fewer people go to church than they do in Japan. So, you know, 0.01% of people in Hull, I think, something like that, go to church. So it's a very needy country in parts of our country. Other parts, we have some strength and some life and growth. In London is one of the growing dioceses in our country. So each diocese is a bit different. It's a patchwork. And some great signs of growth, great signs of unity amongst those of us who are gospel-minded, reformed, evangelical people. And that's good. We need to pray that we can maintain that. And trying to build bridges with others who are maybe a bit higher up the candle than we are, but would still be orthodox on issues of morality and the creeds and biblical truth. You know, there are some people who just believe stuff rather than not believing stuff. And we need to work together, and we're trying to do that where that's possible. So do pray for us, because we're needy as a country spiritually, and the church needs unity amongst those who believe.
Very good. Your Grace, could you explain ACNA's relationship to the communion? Any particular updates you can share with us this evening?
Sure. The Anglican Church in North America, our province, is in full communion with about 50 million, a little over 50 million, of the 70 million Anglicans in the world. The GAFCON provinces would say that we are in full communion, and I, as the primate, sit on the GAFCON Primates Council. The Global South folks, which is a whole nother entity of the Anglican communion, we're in full communion with them as well, and they recognize us as well, and I was just elected to their, I sit on the Primates Council there, just elected to their steering committee, which is like a vestry, I guess would be the best way to say it, of the Global South. We are not in communion with the Archbishop of Canterbury, although we've got a friendship, good relationship. And the Church of England did just recognize our orders, meaning that they consider now our ordinations historically valid, and our clergy can now serve in their churches without having to be reordained, which was some bishops were requesting our clergy to do that if they wanted to get a job in a church there. And so that was good news. We just had a great meeting with the GAFCON primates, and they highly respect the Anglican Church in North America and what's happening here. It actually blows my mind how much they respect us when we're such a, I feel like we're like a drop in the bucket compared to who they are. But it's incredible respect.
Thank you. Dr. Gatiss, the Archbishop mentioned GAFCON. What kind of influence or presence does GAFCON have with the Church of England?
I think at the last GAFCON, which I was present, I enjoyed being there in Nairobi to meet the primates and others who were there. There were, I think, 120 delegates from the UK who were invited to GAFCON. So there are many of us who are playing a part in GAFCON and proud to be there and looking forward to the next one. More widely than that?
More widely. Is the presence felt in the hierarchy of the Church of England? You know, are they effective? Is GAFCON effective in bringing some change, can I use the word reformation, to the Church of England?
No. I don't say that easily, but I don't think that's the case. I don't think they are. We would like that. I'd like anything that will help bring reformation and life and positivity to the Church of England would be a good thing in my book. I don't think we've quite got it right yet in terms of the interface of those 50 million Anglicans elsewhere in the world who are our beloved brothers and sisters. I don't think we've quite got the interface between them and the English scene right, for a number of reasons. And it's not being as effective as it might be, I guess. But that's because there's a lot of resistance from the hierarchy of the Church of England to the GAFCON agenda. Many of our bishops were there at GAFCON. You know, there are some great examples. Keith Sinclair, Birkenhead, the Bishop of Winchester was there. Other bishops, the Bishop of Blackburn is a great man. But many of our bishops would be very wary about GAFCON, very suspicious of what's going on, and touchy about overlapping jurisdictions and such things. I mentioned this to Archbishop Foley the other day. I said, nervousness about overlapping jurisdictions, and he told me that you have overlapping jurisdictions in your overlapping jurisdictions. So it's a bit more of a spaghetti soup, right. I guess, over here. But in England, there's some touchiness about that amongst our hierarchy. And I don't know if Justin Welby is universally positive about GAFCON, which is a shame, isn't it?
I would say he's not.
which is a shock and a sadness.
It's that's a helpful transition, because I want to give the last question to the Archbishop, and it's potentially a loaded one. So the alphabet soup, right? I don't think there's anyone in here who envies your position in building this province called ACNA. We've got all kinds of constituting jurisdictions, including this one, REC, formerly PEAR now, and others. And then we have the continuing churches that don't seem to want to play.
They don't.
Yeah. So we've used this term before. I think we used it last year. We call it Operation Humpty Dumpty. Right? So give us an update on Operation Humpty Dumpty and talk about, I guess, particularly what Cana's contribution can be and is.
Well, first, I wouldn't use the word, the analogy of Humpty Dumpty. I would use the wall that we're building, Nehemiah style. That would be the...
Are you building a wall and getting the Episcopal Church to pay for it? I'm sorry, I couldn't resist.
Yes. Absolutely. Oh, that's very good. But as far as the alphabet soup, I just think, we're in the midst of, really we are in the midst, we're talking about the 500 year of a Reformation. We're in the midst of a Reformation of some sort, not just in the Anglican world, but in all of Christianity. And it's going to be messy for a while. And I've just come to own it, that it's just going to be, I've just got to be flexible. But that being said, and I've said this publicly a few times, but our College of Bishops, who come from all the different alphabet soup, are the most godly men that I've ever been around. And I've been ministry now over 40 years. And, I mean, these men are incredible. And the tone and how we do our business, not that we don't have vigorous fellowship. I mean, we do. You know what that is? Vigorous fellowship? You know. But these are really godly men. I mean, we'll, in the midst of a discussion, someone will say, why don't we just stop and seek the Lord on this and pray? And we will. I mean, and it's a whole different atmosphere. And so with that said, the unity that's happened in our College of Bishops, to me, is a precursor of what's happening in the province. And no matter what issue comes our way, I mean, some of these things that you look at are being thrown at us all the time, especially the culture keeps throwing us things. They could be terrifying. But I look at our bishops and I know the Lord is going to guide us and show us how to get through this. So the way we were formed, I mean, we all kind of went in our different, as we call them, lifeboats. And it's just going to take a while for it to all come. But right now, we're doing really well. It's very encouraging. So,
follow-up question. What, in your view, are the greatest threats to achieving unity within ACNA? Is it women in holy orders? Is it the prayer book revision? Is it perhaps a failure to discipline Tory Balcom? I say that with all degree of seriousness.
I know we have the press here, but he will be disciplined. Don't quote me on that, but it will happen.
He's not promising.
The greatest threat,
I think the greatest, there's two things. One is the culture. I know the president has surrounded himself with Christians. Many of his advisors are very strong Christians, and we're way off the path. And so it looks like we're pulled back a little bit. Like today, the announcement about he just released executive order or something, basically allowing churches to be more involved in politics without the IRS coming after them. Yeah, the Johnson Amendment. So anyway, it looks like we're being pulled back a little bit, but that's an illusion. The tidal wave is coming. I mean, the water's receding, and we got this tidal wave coming. And that, to me, how we respond to that, are we going to respond to that with the gospel and in gospel ways, or are we going to allow it to turn us against each other? So that's one. I think the other, and this is the one that drives me nuts now, this is the Anglican way. Real Anglicans do it this way. And I have to say, in my travels around the world, all the different Anglican churches that I've been to, I am stunned at the variety of what is called Anglicanism. And so if we fall into a pride of being locked into it has to be our way, that will definitely divide us. I mean, I go to England, and you guys in the UK are, you know, you do have some good things going, but I mean, you really do. But I go to a beautiful cathedral, and see if I can. I mean, actually, it worked, but the lights going up the side of the arches were colored. The service was very low church. The pastor didn't wear vestments, and the place was overflowing with people. And they had Holy Communion early in the morning, and then this service was more of a version of morning prayer. Then I go to Uganda, and the service is high church. I mean really high church. I go to Sydney, and I'm preaching in the Cathedral of Sydney. Beautiful St. Andrew's Cathedral there. Have you been there? Beautiful. So I wear my collar, and I'm stretching them by wearing my collar because their clergy don't even wear a collar. They wear an open shirt. Again, it's all Anglican, and they hold us certain prayer book rubrics and that sort of thing, but there's so much latitude. So if we get locked into saying, well, you guys aren't really Anglican, which I've heard in some places, that will hurt us tremendously. We've got to figure a way to embrace and help each other value the strength in the other's position. Does that make sense?